Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Heart of Sports with Jason Springer and Jeff Cohen, powered by Elec 825. We are thrilled to join you on WWDB 860 AM and the 97.5 HD2 network, a part of Beasley Media Group, ready to help you move into the weekend talking about all the news in the world of sports. Jeff, I normally would ask you about Thursday Night Football, but I'm not even going to go there.
Oh, thank you very much.
Because after the amount of time that you and I spent a few weeks ago watching the release of the four-part ESPN 30 for 30 Once Upon a Time in Queens.
I've watched it twice.
I know you have.
I know.
And that's only because you haven't had more free time.
That's
you
right.
would have watched it more if you had a little more time on your hands. Mm-hmm. Who better to have on come and talk about it with us? Producer, director, Nick Davis joins us to talk about it all. Nick, thanks so much for giving us a few minutes today.
Thank you so much for having me, guys.
Nick, I got to thank you. As somebody who was, I was in college, I was a freshman in college, the 1986 year, and that documentary brings back so many memories of that time. And I know you're a Mets fan. What was it like for you to do that? And to go through that and live that with the actual players?
It was a dream. I mean, I can't... I was just actually thinking, and we didn't have time for it in the film, but I went down to Philadelphia. I'm a huge Mets fan, and I was, I guess, a junior in college. And I went down to Philadelphia to see the Mets clinch in September, and they did. They got swept by the Phillies. And it was just such an incredible time to be a fan of a team that had been so bad for so long and then came together, piece by piece in the early 80s until by 86 they were this juggernaut. And it was such a thrill for me then. And so I just can't put into words what it's like to then, 35 years later to be able to tell their story. It was a dream.
So it's one thing to be a fan and get to watch it. It's another thing to get to tell the story. But not only did you tell the story, you got the league's blessing, and that translated into sort of the most comprehensive collection of video footage and archival material that we've seen about the team. Can you talk about that process and how that added to what you were able to do in telling this story?
Well, the league, luckily enough, if this had been about the 85 Mets, if the 85 Mets had broken through and won a World Series, we wouldn't have had nearly the archive that we got for 86. For some reason, the Mets had a documentary film crew that intermittently followed the team that year. It wasn't major, it wasn't every day, but it was enough to give us some behind-the-scenes footage that most people had never seen before. And in particular, when you get to the playoffs and World Series, it gave us some shots that were just, magical. I think, what's great about Major League Baseball at this point with this kind of film is they exercised no editorial control. They were like, look, we trust that you're not out to get us. You're not out to get these guys. These guys obviously had a lot of personal problems that they are willing to discuss and display, but you're going to tell the whole complete story and from start to finish. And so it was just fantastic to have them as a partner, because in addition to also just being able to get every Met game that was recorded and all the radio broadcasts from that year, they just had a tremendous archive. And for some reason, there was a major jump up in 86 in all of their archives.
Well, is that because they were also great recording artists in 86?
Exactly. Yes. Rap stars, you haven't heard songs like that.
We talked with Ed Hearn last week about his starring role in that 1986 Mets video. So we made sure to get that story. You mentioned something, though, about the players being willing to talk. They didn't seem reluctant when participating at all. Were you surprised how open some of these players were with you? And can you talk about what the interview process was like?
Yeah, I think some of them were a little reluctant initially because, look, this is a story that's been told in bits and pieces in other documentaries and certainly in books and articles, but no one had ever approached it from, the era of the long form documentary where we had 4 hours to tell the whole story. And I think some of them thought, oh, you're just out to get us again. And as soon as we sat down and started talking to them, I think they realized, oh, wait a minute, this guy's actually asking us, about our whole lives, not just zeroing in on, so what was it like doing cocaine in New York, or any of the sort of gotcha kind of things. So I think they all felt like, all right, they're going to do this right. And I was surprised at how open they all were. I think those who, you know, maybe haven't had the best lives wanted to tell their stories in kind of a cautionary tale kind of way, like, don't do what I did. You know, certainly Doc Gooden and Daryl Strawberry, I think, want to get their stories out there and feel like people can learn from some of their mistakes. And I think to some extent the same is true of Lenny Dykstra, who has not had the easiest time. But then, like Keith Hernandez, I was completely surprised that he went so deep into his very complicated relationship with his father, and he could have painted it in much, you know, broader strokes, and he could have also just said, I'm not going to even try and explain how complicated it was with my dad, who I loved but had this complicated relationship with. So yeah, it was wonderful to talk to them all and be the sort of recipient of so much openness.
You know, we've talked to athletes in the past about, we even talked to like people like Tim Tebow about the parent-child relationship growing up in sports. And then you have this story, which I really wasn't expecting, was this story about Keith Hernandez and his father and the way that his father was calling him every, like after every at bat, and that apparently Keith Hernandez's biggest regret was that he got his dad a dish. Was that something that you knew going into it, or was that something that because he starts to feel comfortable, he starts to divulge this information and just share?
Well, a little of both. I mean, Keith wrote a really good autobiography or portion of an autobiography, mostly just about his early struggles up until his years with the Cardinals a couple of years ago. And a lot of his relationship with his father is in there. But there's something about it in print that's just different from actually having him talk to you or talk to an audience, because you feel it on an emotional level in a different way. And he did, I think, go into greater detail than in with us than he did in his own book. It was mutual. I mean, Keith is going back to Davey Johnson's office and calling his dad. The problem is that his dad was sometimes saying, you know, I told you before, you close your stance, you know, or whatever it is. And they really got into it, so much so that they had a huge fight in the summer of 86 and didn't talk all summer. And that was actually from a Sports Illustrated article I read the summer of 86, late that summer, a great piece by, I think, William Hawk is the sports writer's name. And it was in that piece that he said that he hadn't been talking to his dad all summer. That wasn't in the book, but I asked him about it because of that article.
All right, well, I do have to ask one more question about Keith Hernandez. What was up with the cat?
His cat's great. I mean, the cat is, I guess, you know, people knew that he had this cat. And so we started the interview in his condo in Florida outside on a little, you know, patio or whatever. And the boats in the harbor behind him, and then actually a lawnmower, was just too loud. So we went inside, and that's where the cat had been. And the cat just immediately jumped up and was on his lap. And you know, a few of the people on set were like, well, what can we do with the cat? And it was clear, like, Keith was comfortable with the cat there. So we just said, well, let's just roll and we'll see what happens. And it couldn't have gone better. I was very, very happy with Haji's participation.
So unlike you and Jeff, I wasn't the Mets fan growing up. But the 86 World Series is sort of my first real memory of baseball playoffs and that intensity of watching the game with my dad. How was it for you to capture the way that Game 6 went in that series and to relive it with the players? What was that like?
What was most fun, if I don't know if fun is the right word, but was to play for Mookie Wilson the audio. And we just listened in the interview room. As we listened to the entire at bat with Mookie Wilson, listening to the radio call from Bob Murphy. And that to me was just a very, very special moment. And only a couple of seconds made it into the film, but it was really, you felt like, wow, it did change all their lives. Like Bobby Ojeda says, like, it was just a moment, but it changed all their lives. And they all remember it so vividly and so well, and, you know, so happily. And it's great to have those moments that, I mean, obviously Red Sox fans and people who were not rooting for the Mets remember it negatively, but even they, it's not a serious negativity. It's not, you know, a national tragedy, but to have a moment where we can all remember where we were, and it's so, you know, emblazoned in our memories, it's just really fun. And it was great to hear it from all those guys.
Yeah, I have to tell you, that at bat and the way that you covered that game from beginning to end, it's edge of your seat to the point, I'm always amazed that people who are good at documentaries can take something that we all already know the facts. It's not like a fiction movie where you don't know the ending. We know what the ending is, and as you're watching it, you almost forget and don't want to know the ending as you're watching it. Mm-hmm. What was it like for you to, you know what the ending is, but to cover it that way and cover every pitch and what everybody was thinking, and even the players leading up to that and all the chaos that was going on, what was it like to go through? We all lived that moment. You're now sitting there with them going through their recollections of every second of that.
Kevin Mitchell coming up was the thing that stunned me.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Well, thank you very much, first of all. And I have to give a shout out to the editor of that episode, Josh Fried, who did a fantastic job of weaving all those stories together. You know, it was so fun. I mean, it was and it was so great that we got to hear from all of them. And they all remembered it so specifically. You know, a lot of athletes' memories are faulty, you know, but in that inning, they all remembered it perfectly. They just nailed it exactly down to the, well, then I fouled it off and then I knew he was going to throw me the slider and I was waiting for the slider. And, you know, all that stuff was just so fun and terrific.
So towards the end of episode 4, you have Doc Gooden talking about watching the parade from a drug house, which, you know, that I wasn't as familiar with that story, and it's compelling to watch and hear him recount it. One, what was that like for you? And then two, were there other stories that you came across that you found particularly compelling throughout this?
Yeah, that was heartbreaking. And I, you know, as a Mets fan, I remember that he missed the parade and that the New York Times reported the next day that he'd missed it because he had the sniffles. And we all
he did, apparently.
Exactly.
And nowadays, that would be an excuse now.
Right. Exactly. No, I mean, it was, I went into the interview knowing, okay, this will be a moment we have to get to. What I didn't know we were going to get to in so much, and to answer the second part of your question, like the trauma that Dwight Gooden went through in his childhood was a complete surprise to me. As Met fans, we knew Daryl Strawberry came from a bad background. Dwight Gooden came from a good background. In the sort of broad strokes as a fan, that's what we were told in the 80s. And he had a middle-class family, and his father and mother came to the games, and you just felt like, okay, Daryl, haunted, troubled, great talent, but it's going to be difficult. Dwight, angel, perfect. This is going to be amazing. And so to hear the trauma and that his mother shot his father at one point because Dwight had accidentally let her know about an affair that his father was having. I mean, that's like, you know, Greek tragedy kind of stuff. Thankfully, he lived, the father lived, and they stayed married. But, you know, I had no idea the depth of the trauma that Dwight Gooden went through in his childhood. That was completely news to me. And there's more. I mean, there's actually another story that we didn't have time for of him being at a house where his sister gets shot in the head when he's like 6 years old. And it's just like stunning. Now, we didn't have time for all those things. And I should say we're lucky enough to have this oral history, this book that came out that sort of contains a lot of the stories that we just didn't have time for in the film. But yeah, I mean, to get back to your point, I mean, there were so many moving stories that these guys told that it was just what made them great in the 80s was not just how talented they were, but they were so compelling as personalities, and the same remains true today. Even if you didn't like them in the 80s, you couldn't deny that they were captivating. You couldn't avoid the 86 Mets. And the same is true now. These are really interesting people, and interesting characters is what makes for an interesting documentary.
You know, you mentioned that you didn't have time to tell the story. there must be so many things that are sitting on the cutting room floor. Of all of those things that we didn't get to see, what do you think is the one that you most say, I wish I could hear that, or I wish I would have put that in there?
Well, it's funny because I hadn't thought about this. The other story from Dwight's childhood really is traumatizing. And it's not like I wish we'd put it in, because it's like, how many traumas can you put in one man's childhood? But there's a great, really intense story that Ray Knight told that I kind of wish we'd had time for, but it is thankfully in the companion book. And they're in St. Louis, and it's a hot day, and Gary Carter is outside signing autographs, because that's what Gary Carter does. And the rest of the team is on the bus, and Strawberry is getting angrier and angrier, and he leans his head out the window and he says, "Hey, Camera Carter, get your butt in here and come on." And like, he starts yelling at Carter, and Carter gets on the bus and he's furious, and he starts storming towards the back of the bus where Strawberry is, and Strawberry comes storming towards the front of the bus, and Ray Knight stands up in the middle of them and sticks his hands out and stops the two of them and says, "Hey, we're not going to fight each other." And to me, that story said so much about his leadership and their attitude and their toughness, and the fact that they knew they fought, and they're going to fight everyone else. They're not going to fight each other. So I wish we'd had time for that story, but I've told you now.
Yeah, and Nick, if you have a couple more minutes, the other thing that I just want to discuss is, one, the companion piece. So we have this book, Once Upon a Time in Queens, and it is so great. I don't know whose idea it was to put this out with this, but it's incredible. How do you have time to do that, the documentary, and you have another new book?
Well, I know. So I, from the minute I was able to get this project off the ground, I was saying to them, this has to be a book. We have to have a companion book. Like, we're going to have so many stories. Let's do it. So thankfully, because we're having transcribers and everything, it was a lot of work to pull it together, especially because the publication or the due date for the manuscript was before we'd edited the fourth episode. So it was very hard, especially for the later chapters. And it's why the later chapters, frankly, are a little fuller than the early chapters. Even so, everything contains many stories that we just weren't able to fit in the film. And I also, years ago, started a companion book about a documentary about my grandfather, Herman Mankiewicz, and his brother, Joe Mankiewicz. And the companion book is called Competing with Idiots, Herman and Joe Mankiewicz, A Dual Portrait. And it took me 19 years to write, in part because there was no film. So I there was going to be this documentary film. This was going to be a companion book. And the film went away, and I was left with the book contract that I had to fulfill. And I'm enormously proud and pleased that I did. And I don't know how I did it all. I did it all because I had to do these two things. You can't walk away from a book about your family, and you have to do this project about your, favorite team of all time. I can sleep later.
Well, what do you do after this? You cover one of the most interesting teams in baseball history, and then you cover your family, which also covers one of the most interesting periods, because if, for people who don't know, your grandfather was the screenwriter of Citizen Kane. What do you do next? How do you top it?
I've got another film that I'm just starting to get off the ground that I'm really excited about. It's nothing will ever be as sort of pressure packed as these two because I cared so deeply about them going into it. But on the other hand, I think that, I'm not worried about that. I think it'll be fun, and it'll be a little easier to, I've made films about things I knew nothing about, and that can be a lot of fun. This one, the one I'd like to get off the ground, I can't talk about it, but it would be really fun, and it has to do with sports, and I'll come back and talk about it.
Yeah, I was going
to
say,
able to complete it.
When you get that one off the ground, we hope you'll come back and give us a little time. We really appreciate, first of all, the work that you did, because we've enjoyed watching it, Jeff, more than me, of course. But second, for giving us a little time to talk about it today. Thanks so much.
Oh, well, thank you guys. This was fun.
You have a great one, man. Jeff. Jeff, that was like your dream, right? To relive the 86 Mets right there with the man.
It was. And, since that time, I've become a Phillies fan, which is even odder.
But it is very odd.
Like I don't look at the Mets now as the same team. Like, it's really weird. Like, in my own, like, I've tried to figure out.
So the 86 Mets aren't the Mets?
No, they're the 86 Mets. Like my childhood has been separated from my adulthood. And when I moved here, I switched, and I don't know when it happened. I can't tell you the specific day. I can tell you there was a point at which I took my 3-year-old or 4-year-old son to a Mets spring training game, bought a hat, and I came home, and he threw it in the trash and said, "You're now a Philly fan."
And that's when you were a Philly fan.
I already kind of was.
Appreciate that, Alex.
But you know, we all have. I mean, the one great thing about sports, the reason you and I mean, we spend so much time talking about it, is because not just because of the event itself, but how the event has impacted you and how your relationships with your family, who you go with, and your friends, how that impacts your life. And so there are certain moments that trigger that. For me, that 86 Mets team was, I was a freshman in college, and I can tell you everybody that I was sitting with in the lounge of my dorm watching it. And I can tell you the reactions to Tim Tuffel letting the ball through his legs and Mookie Wilson and that hit and all of that. And even though I can't remember what I ate earlier today, I can remember that entire series and that moment in my life and how much those people – I have shared that again with people I was sitting with in 1986.
You've met my wife. You see how she thinks I'm ridiculous at times with the amount of sports that I watch.
At times.
She knew that I needed to do a sports radio show when she heard all of the particular memories I had at individual sporting events, that I remembered every detail when we get in the car to drive together and I go, "When did they knock that down? We passed something." And she goes, "3 years ago." I'm oblivious to almost everything sometimes, but sports memories are like seared into my brain.
So I have an idea for you.
This is dangerous.
Once we figure out.
The last time you had an idea, you ended up getting dunked on, by the way.
This is going to be your father-son moment. Is at some point, Ben Simmons is going to get traded, right?
You assume. Well, he's
and when he gets traded and he comes back, assuming that he is brave enough to play in that game, you have got to take your son to that game.
Yes. Nope.
Because the things that will come at us, knowing what your kid has
only
said so
that
far,
he can get the frosty freeze out when Ben misses the free throw.
Exactly. He'll be his favorite player. He will want a Simmons Indiana Pacers jersey. Those moments will happen. Because can you imagine when Ben comes? I don't think he'll play. I honestly think that when he's traded, if he comes back here, he could be the healthiest person on the planet. He will not play in this arena.
It's really funny you say that about a New Jersey, and we'll go to break after this, and then we'll come back, talk a few minutes before we have Mel Renfro, Super Bowl champion, NFL Hall of Famer, on to talk. My son Brandon had, it must have been a shirt, extra shirt at school, and he must have gotten something on a shirt, and so he came home, and he's wearing the Sixer shirt, and it's got Simmons 25 on the back.
Did he get booed?
My neighbor goes, "I think you're going to need to get him a new T-shirt."
But. Yeah, they're like, "What kind of parent
so
are you?"
Even my neighbors are judging me now because my son is wearing Ben Simmons' name. We'll talk more about that and everything else when we get back. Let's hit the break.
Since your last name is Springer.
That's right. Hit the break.
Operating engineers are the men and women that move mountains. And the Engineers Labor Employer Cooperative, ELEC, puts them to work. They create opportunities for the men, women, and union signatory contractors of Local 825, repaving our roads, keeping our homes bright and warm, and even building our favorite team stadium. We understand infrastructure. That's why ELEC and Local 825 are ready to get to work.
We're back here. So, Jeff, the Sixers this week made lots of news. They started playing games. Allen Iverson wants to come back here, apparently. Ben Simmons does not want to come back here still, apparently.
Well, we covered Ben Simmons. I mean, unless you have other questions for me, because I really want to talk about Allen Iverson.
I know you do.
Yeah.
I want to ask you, Ben, you were on Keith Pompey's Locked on Sixers podcast, and you guys were talking about the Indiana deal.
Right.
Are you at a point...
Proposal. It's not a deal.
Proposal.
No. Yeah.
Potentially Caris LeVert, Malcolm Brogdon, and a pick.
Yes.
Obviously, there's other things out there. Where are you at this point? Are you at a trade him for anything you can get?
No, I'm not at that.
Okay. Are you at a hold him... Wait, hold on.
Yeah.
There's three options. Make him sit out. Just Cause, if you can't get anything.
Just Cause.
Trade him, like, hold out for that Dame Lillard or somebody where you have to move other players in a deal or take whatever you can get.
Well, one and two go together. I mean, not Just Cause. Here's my belief. Nobody cares about the first half of the regular season. The reason that the NBA doesn't do anything until Christmas, essentially, is because they know nobody cares until football season's almost over. So, and the Sixers have a good enough team, they're going to make the playoffs anyway. So there is no rush to get rid of him for nothing. What you do is you hold out. You've heard the story. You've seen the stories. Ben's already gotten to a point. They didn't realize how much money they were going to lose as a result of this.
How is that not possible?
If that's the case, somebody's
if that's the case,
somebody's not doing their job.
I'm questioning the agency.
Yeah, but the fact is, you hold out. Whatever deal you can get now, you likely can get at the trade deadline. The whatever you're going to get now is not going to be the best deal that you can possibly make. So at this point, if you believe that they should have done it sooner, it's too late now to go back in time, but you can fix this by going forward. And the problem with it is what happens if Ben does show up?
Well, he's okay. Going to.
Says who?
He's going to end up showing up. He's not going to keep on to be, because
he is afraid to show his face.
I'm not saying he's going to play. I said he's going to show up.
So okay, we'll see. I don't.
Said he's not fine.
It makes no sense that he doesn't show. What he should have done, and I'm not saying it's the honest thing to do. What he should have done is he should have shown up.
And
they would all sit there and pretend he had an injury.
Yes.
Everybody in the league would know about it. People could save face, and then they could make a trade.
Well, look, the other day we opened our Sixers app, and we've got Ben Simmons all in showing up there. So apparently they're all in with him.
Well, they're all in with everybody except Allen Iverson, right?
All right, you're very bothered by Allen's...
I'm bothered by the outrage.
Okay, so we'll lay out the story. Allen Iverson said this week in an interview that, you know, he's not trying to slight the fans, but basically he believes he should have some type of position with the organization. You don't like which part of it? Do you not care that he's making the comments, he's entitled to it, but that people are outraged that he's saying it? Where are you?
He's entitled to want a job if he wants a job. I don't have to go through Allen Iverson's entire off-the-court history to tell you that based on that off-the-court history, if I was running an organization, he's not the person that I would want in the front office.
Is there a role for him, though?
I'm sure there is. If you want to put him in the World Be Free role kind of thing, okay, I get it. But that doesn't appear to be what Allen wants. Allen was talking about the fact that he could evaluate talent. Based on what? We don't know that. When has he ever done it? So he thinks he should just walk in because he was talented. That we all have seen incredible basketball players and other athletes. They don't make good coaches. So what makes him think that he can evaluate talent? He hasn't done it. He hasn't said, hey, let me at least go be a scout for a while. Go sit in other arenas and give you some ideas. That hasn't come across. What are you going to do, put him as CFO? I mean, it. What bothers me most is that is this fake outrage at somehow the Sixers are doing him wrong because they're not giving him a job because he gave them so much. The Sixers gave him something too, a whole bunch of money. You don't have an entitlement to a lifetime position because of something you do before. We all know that sports is what have you done for me lately. So this is not like some new theme.
Is it that other teams have stars back involved
some,
in their leadership
some
or ownership that this is looked on poorly here?
Is every professional star athlete involved in the organization they were with?
No.
Some are, some aren't.
And it's hard to talk about Allen because he's, you know, you either love him
flawed.
Or you weren't. You know, you looked at the other side of the AI, not the game,
yes.
the other stuff that came with it. And so it's hard to have that conversation with people. But I find the outrage around him making the comments just like, you know, all of a sudden it's like, how dare the Sixers not hire him? Or how dare Allen have that opinion? Like, who cares?
People
have
agenda.
Opinions.
That's right. And you want to have your opinion, that's fine. It's the outrage that bothers
me. We talked with Keith about...
Because the people with the outrage, it's all the fact that this is just an agenda.
We talked with Keith about clickbait. To me, that was just a clickbait headline. Like, oh, Allen Iverson's mad at the Sixers because they won't hire him.
Yeah, but a network's made, you know, hours out of this.
Like, just... I don't understand sometimes. I really don't. It doesn't make sense to me. Anyway, Sixers have two more preseason games left before they get things underway for real in 12 days against the Pelicans.
And they don't know who their starting point guard is.
Yeah. That. What?
I don't get that story at all. I you know, sometimes I wonder, coaches have to say things. This was not
Please
one.
Please tell me that's one of them.
He didn't have to say this. He didn't have to say, well, you know, sometimes we're going to use this point guard as a starter and this one as a, you don't need to say that stuff. I know it hurts your feelings. Because you want Maxey as the starter.
No, I think Maxey will as the starter.
You want Maxey as the starter. It's okay to say
Love Maxey. I want Maxey to have a role and develop. You think that I think that he's like ready to be prime time now.
Yes.
I've just thought that he has talent that they shouldn't throw him
away. Do you think he should be the starting point guard now?
Out of the choices they have, yes. Mm-hmm. But okay. I don't think he's good enough to necessarily be a starting point guard in the NBA.
Okay, well then if Maxey's not the starting point guard on this team, if Ben Simmons is not here based on the current roster, or who is?
Well, that's the problem.
They don't have another point. Like Shake Milton is not a point guard.
That's the thing. You say
he is a shooting
you
guard.
Say it as like I want Maxey. It's like who
you
else
do.
Is it going to be? Shake
you
Milton.
Love Maxey. Why are you not embracing your fan love for Tyrese Maxey?
I do, but I think he's being forced into a role that he's not ready yet for. If he'd be much better as the backup point guard coming off the bench with Shake playing another role instead of him being the starting point guard and Shake being the point guard to run.
So then would you take the risk of the Malcolm Brogdon, the oft-injured Caris LeVert, and a pick?
Not yet. I would probably wait.
Brogdon solves your point guard problem, right?
He does, but you're a Michigan man. Caris LeVert hasn't been healthy since he's been college.
I spent a whole podcast with Keith saying, look, as much as I love Caris LeVert, I went through season by season. He's not played full seasons.
And that's the problem. But okay, the reason that I like that is because...
And he's injured right now.
The only reason, other than you get yourself a point guard in Brogdon and you can debate whether he actually fills the need, is that you're not giving up other assets because you have to dump Ben. Like, that's my concern, is when you go into a larger deal to try and go superstar hunting,
yep.
In order to bury the depleted asset that is Ben Simmons right now, you have to give other assets that you believe could be good.
You're going to.
Either Thybul or not in that Indiana trade.
You're going to. But why don't we talk to a guy who actually didn't need to be traded for anything because he made the Hall of Fame?
Yeah, like anytime you can be joined by a member of the NFL Hall of Fame class, 1996, member of more important team, Gridiron Greats Assistance Fund. So much fun to be joined by Mel Renfro. Mel, thanks for giving us a few minutes today.
Glad to be here. Always willing to help, and especially with great friend Mike Ditka and what he's done so much over the years. Glad to be a part of it.
Well, so Mel, let's start with that. You know, we've had some of your other fellow alumni who've been part of the Gridiron Greats Assistance Fund. What drew you to it, and what do you see as the biggest thing that still needs to be done as part of this fund and part of taking care of the previous classes of NFL players?
Well, you know, back in my day, Mike Ditka, when we were starting out, there wasn't the great big contracts, the great deals of money that the players made, and the players weren't really taken care of, and a lot of guys were unable to pay their rent, weren't able to take care of their medical needs, and that was so much well needed. So now, with the need for it, and Mike stood up and created the Gridiron Greats, and provide an avenue in the raise funds where these guys could come and request monies to take care of those needs, which was very much needed. And, you know, it's grown, and with the Pork Rind people being a part of this effort, it's just blossomed. And, you know, I've been a part of it since the beginning, and still a part of it, and I'm glad to participate and help in any way that I can.
Why do you think it is so hard to get the NFL and NFLPA to support your generation of the players that you have to turn to these efforts?
You know, that's a question I am asked all the time, and you know, the answer that comes to me is they just won't. You know, it's kind of ridiculous that they make such tremendous amounts of money. I mean, you know, and you can pay a guy millions and millions of dollars a year, and you know, you can't lend a hand to a poor guy who has medical needs, financial needs, you know, who never made $100,000 a year. I don't know. It's the powers that be. You know, the owners make so much money, and they're in control of it. They were in control of it when I was playing. You know, they're pretty much in control of it now. It's just a question mark that might always be there. But, you know, if we can do what we can as former players and, you know, guys like Mike Ditka that know what the need is and know how to get in there and you know, get the guys to work together and getting people to, you know, donate, you know, it'll be a great day for those people, those guys, players that are in need.
You know, Mel, we talked to Keyshawn Johnson a couple weeks ago about, I don't know if you've seen the book, The Forgotten First. It was about the first four African-American football players in the NFL. And as we were reading about that and talking about that, I was looking into some other things. And one of the things that came up was your important role in the NFL and in Dallas with regard to fair housing. You seem like somebody who is willing to use your platform to tackle important issues. What made you decide to get involved in that issue and to decide that you were going to use the platform you had as an NFL player to tackle these issues?
Well, you know, at the time I may have been a little bit crazy and not really knowing what was going to come out of it. You know, I was came from Portland, Oregon, and it hadn't been, hadn't been touched with the depth of some of the racism and the that type of thing. So, you know, I stood up when something happened, and bang, I got slapped. But you know, I survived it. You know, what I did was the right thing to do, and it. And from what I heard later, I got many phone calls and many people that told me how much they appreciated what I had done and how much I helped their cause and them getting what they needed to get done because of, you know, the things, how I stepped forward and did and said the things I did. And I know I won't regret it. And, you know, you hope more players will do the same thing. And, you know, guys like Mike Ditka that goes so far back and with such a big name has done so much for so many causes. And with the Gridiron Greats and the Pork Ryan situation, you know, it's just one part of what is a great need as far as moving the effort forward to help these indigent players that have medical problems and financial problems.
You know, you talk about taking a stand and using your platform and doing the right thing. We talk with athletes about that all the time. And in your Hall of Fame speech, you talked about helping young people, and you said athletes need to be role models. We need to present an image of people who want to do the right thing. Can you talk about how you did that, and then what advice you would give athletes of today who are trying to make their own way and figure out how they can use the platform that they have to make an impact?
Well, you know, you always have to take the position of leadership. And in doing that, always do the right thing, always say the right thing, always, when you're in a group and you have a platform, you know, it's always what is the right thing to do. It's not about greed. It's not about, you know, an overabundance of money. It's not about being first. You know, it's all about teamwork. It's all about togetherness. It's all about having each other's back. And it's all about working hard. And it's all about consistency and staying together. And one great thing about the Cowboys were a lot of the players stayed together and played together for so long, got to know each other very well, and that's why we were so successful, because we knew each other and we had each other's back. And I think that's what it takes nowadays for players to to really form strong relationships and stand together no matter, you know, what it is that's out there, you know, work together, stand together, play together, and be a team.
And before we talk a little bit more about Pork Rind Appreciation Day and what you're doing for Gridiron Greats one more time, I had a question about early in your career. And as I was reading about you, I saw that despite the fact that you were a great defensive back, you were moved to running back, only to have Dan Reeves replace you, and then you went back to the place that you had made your bread and butter and became a Hall of Famer. What was that moment like when they came to you and said, we want you to switch positions, and by the way, we're going to have you switch back?
Well, Coach Landry was a great innovator in many ways in defense, offense. Well, during my first 3 years, I ran back punts and kickoffs and actually led the league. And I gained more yards than our running back carrying the football. And he said, well, let's use this as a weapon on offense. But unfortunately, my third year, as I started offense, I broke my foot first game, first quarter, and was never really to recover from that foot injury. And, of course, Dan Reeves came in and did a tremendous job. And, of course, me, you know, being versatile as I was, as soon as my injury healed, you know, I got back on defense and just started to play, and still made the Pro Bowl. Missed six games, but made the Pro Bowl, intercepting passes, making the defense better, and of course, playing defense, I think, prolonged my career a lot more years, because it's a lot easier to go hit a guy than, you know, every time you touch the ball, that the 11 guys come in at you, so no regrets there. I loved offense and defense, but I think playing defense prolonged my career. But nevertheless, I was a guy that liked to carry the football. And but after, you know, when I look at the big scheme of thing and the big picture, it all turned out, you know, the way I think God meant for it to be. And being in the Hall of Fame is just probably the greatest thing that could happen to any football player. So I look back on it with fond memories and just congratulate all those new inductees that are coming in, and they're going to know what it feels like, you know, just as soon as they get there and they get that ring, which they just received, they know what the feeling is, and they're going to pass that feeling on to their friends and former teammates.
I could ask you about what that feels like all day, but more importantly, I got to ask you about Pork Rind Appreciation Day and how people can help out to help out the fellow alumni that you guys are looking to support.
Well, you know, those things are addicting. They're delicious for one thing, and they're high in protein, low in carbs, and they're healthy for you. And you know, you can sit and just nibble on those things, and they're doing good. You're contributing to a good cause, a good charity, and enjoying a healthy food. I think that's, you know, no better thing to do on a football Sunday than to watch a football game and eat pork rinds.
Well, we encourage people to go out and get some pork rinds, support the NFL alumni and all you guys are doing with the Gridiron Greats effort with Coach Dicka. Thank you so much for the time, and look forward to seeing what you guys are able to do to help out.
You're certainly welcome. Glad to be on the show.
Jeff, they always take care of each other, even if the NFL isn't going to do it. And it's so hard. It's got to be so hard to get that question. Like, you gave so much to this league. You gave your body. Now people say, like, yeah, they get huge salaries. He didn't.
well, for people who didn't hear it last year, I mean, we had Icky Woods on, who had a serious injury and couldn't get it taken care of unless if it weren't for the Gridiron Greats Fund. And that's the amazing look. Yes, I guess they're not responsible if legally, but the question is morally, what's the right thing to do? And these guys back then, they didn't have the helmets that they have today. They didn't have the technology. They didn't have the medicine. They obviously had worse injuries because they didn't have all of
this.
They
didn't
stuff.
Know about concussions.
Right.
And brain injuries.
And so to not take care of these guys, If this were a situation the NFL didn't have the money, it'd be one thing. But with the billions of dollars that they make.
And new TV contracts coming.
How do you not take care of these people that are the face? I mean, Mel Renfro's bust is in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I got
So how do you not take care of him? Icky Woods is one of the great characters in the history of the game. How do you not take care of these guys? You can go on and on and on. I mean, have you ever seen like video of what Earl Campbell is like today?
No.
This is a guy.
But I assume he has a hard time walking.
Yeah, he was. I mean, you didn't see him play. You've probably seen video.
I've seen the video of it.
But I saw him play. He was a monster when he was out there. He could just run through an entire defense or carry them on his back. But what it did to his body is incredible to see what he looks like today.
Do you think they reach a point where the NFL actually does anything for them?
No.
This is just a...
No, I think that they every once in a while there's a wave of stories on this and then it goes away. And that's the sad part of it. And you have people that are vocal. I mean, could you have a more vocal person than Mike Ditka as the head of this organization?
No, and it's hard, you know, for me to move on to something else because, like, I want to make a joke, but we're talking about something so serious. They're like, how do you transition to a joke?
Well, you could still talk about football, and you could go to the Eagles. And
well, they are a joke.
Exactly. So you don't have to make a joke. Just say Eagles,
the
right?
Larger joke, though, is that you've made my dreams come true, Jeff. You've given me a sports radio show in Philadelphia where I've talked about the Mets and the Cowboys. Thanks, Jeff.
So here's your chance. You got another 10 minutes. Go ahead. Talk about the Eagles.
Oh, glad we could get to the Eagles because exactly. They're doing so well these days. Let's see. Lane Johnson.
Sports in Philadelphia is going swimmingly.
For personal reasons. Nick Sirianni's apparently yelling at his defensive coordinator that it's being leaked out publicly. They still don't know how to run the ball. The defense can't stop anything. But I'll be honest.
Jalen Hurts looks good.
He did look better last week. But
I think he got a quarterback.
Look. The defense gave up 23 points in the first two games.
Yeah.
They gave up 83 points in the next
two games. Yeah, but it was Kansas City. I mean, Kansas City scores on everybody.
I actually thought they played better than I thought they would against Kansas City.
At least the first half.
It's the lack of takeaways that have been difficult, but their offensive struggles, they've scored a touchdown or field goal on 37.5% of their offensive drives. That's only 20th in the league.
So what do you think they need most? What do the Eagles need most? What position?
Oh, my goodness. A linebacker.
Okay. Well, then guess what? Here's what you do. You trade Miles Sanders for a linebacker.
Well, if you're not
going to
use him.
Because you don't need a running back.
If you're not going to use Miles Sanders.
Right.
Like, that's the thing. It's like, I put in here, are they going to run the ball?
Let me guess, he's on your fantasy team.
Of course he is.
See, so there's double outrage.
But that's not
I knew it.
No, that's not even the reason. Look, the Panthers defense gave up 245 rushing yards to the Cowboys. They rank third in the league in total defense. But their rush defense is awful.
Right.
When the Eagles do rush, they have a higher mark at 4 yards a carry than any other team in Kansas City. And yet they won't give the ball to Miles Sanders. And I don't care that he's on my fantasy team.
Yes, you do.
I care.
Well, see, that's the biggest lie you've ever told on the radio.
I care about that. But you have a rookie dropping back.
You said you didn't care.
I don't care is the primary reason why this is an issue.
All right.
I care because you have a rookie dropping back 40-plus times
take judicial notice.
Behind a line that has four replacements in there. It makes no sense to me.
Uh-huh.
Why are you doing that? What is your game plan here?
I don't know. Don't look at me.
Well, apparently they don't know either.
I don't get what Nick Sirianni's doing at all.
When they ask Gannon about the defense, he's running. He goes, well, we don't have a style. Which apparently is why Sirianni blew up with him. But the fact that that's making it into the newspapers is a problem,
Jeff.
Yeah,
the Eagles got to stop doing press conferences. I think that's the answer.
That's
part of it. It's not going to solve who wins and loses, but it'll at least get rid of some of your aggravation, right?
Look, if they don't win this week, it ain't going to get any prettier next week. They got Tom Brady and the Bucks coming to town on Thursday night.
On Thursday night? I might actually watch that one.
Of course you will, so that you can rip me about it on Friday.
No. No. That's right.
That's what you want to do. Vito has a question. I'm going to let him
ask. Go ahead. Raise your hand.
So I have 2 points for you. That was a role reversal.
We don't take points. We have questions.
It was a role reversal there. Jeff served one up, and that was the blow up that he usually has when you serve it up.
Yeah.
My point is, Jalen Smith just got released this week. Obviously, he's already got signed. Right.
He already got signed
by the Packers. But shouldn't the Eagles at least take a flyer on it? It's only going to cost you money. And I know they're up against the cap, but at least take a flyer on it.
It doesn't matter.
Well, look,
he got signed immediately. The Packers just swooped in, and they had an in with him because their coach knew him from college at Notre Dame.
Right. But
so
yes,
you didn't have a shot at
it. But yes, the answer is you should have kicked the tires on it to see if he's healthy or see what it is.
The tires never came into your garage.
But you had no shot. That's why for the Eagles, they need Jalen Hurts to plan out because they're going to need those three picks next year, which right now, you know, right now are three picks in the top 10 next year.
It'll be interesting to see if the Packers and the Cowboys play in the playoffs and Jalen Smith makes a difference, huh?
So how many Eagles fans are
the Jaguars won't
following the Dolphins and the Colts as much as they are the Eagles this year just to see where those draft picks end
I'm now following the Jaguars.
You're following the Jaguars? Okay,
I am.
All right.
I'm absolutely following the Jaguars.
Your buddy,
my favorite
your best
guy.
Buddy, you sent me your picture again with Urban Meyer from the Army-Navy game.
It really is
you
embarrassing that I took
friends.
That picture.
Well, apparently you're not the only one who takes pictures with Urban Meyer, Jeff.
Yes, so, he did not put his hands anywhere inappropriate.
So Urban Meyer, if he's not having enough difficulty on the field with his team, he apparently decided to stay behind after the team lost last Thursday night in Ohio to be with his grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
And after the event, moved over to some location, potentially the same location.
That's the story. That's what got lost at the beginning, is because everybody was talking about the woman grinding up against him. And by the way, I don't know if you saw, they had a practice yesterday, the Jaguars, and as they came out of the huddle, they'd clap and say grind. And you saw lots of the players laughing. Well, so I don't know if that was their motto beforehand. I suspect it wasn't based on the fact that they were laughing.
Has he lost the locker room?
He never had it.
Well, that's the problem.
That's the problem. And I am sick and tired of people saying, well, he won at every other level. Yes, he won at college. It's a different set of rules. There are no rules when you're Florida or you're Ohio State. And he can run the program and he can sweep everything under the rug just like he tried to do. Remember, he had Aaron Hernandez, okay, when he was at Florida. When he was at Ohio State, he left there under bad circumstances. He had a situation in addition where one of his assistant coaches was accused of some bad behavior, and they were very close, and he got in trouble for that.
Didn't he already have a thing with a coach in Jacksonville when he got there?
Well, so then he gets there, and he hires a strength director, whatever you want to call him. And he had issues when he was in college. But Urban Meyer believes that he can do what he wants whenever he wants. And you cannot get away with that when a lot of the players are probably making more than you are. Okay?
But you think there's an ultimate plan for Urban Meyer?
Oh, I think that if the Jaguars go 0-8, that Urban Meyer is going to step down saying he needs to spend time with his family. And that gives him enough time, maybe a month or two, to kind of do what he's supposedly going to do, and then all of a sudden he rears his ugly head in USC or someplace else. I think that's what's going to happen here because he can't survive. He could survive the season if he wants, but all of these leaks about the players saying they laugh at him. When was the last time you ever heard? I've heard stories about people being unhappy with coaches. I've never seen the number of stories about how the fact that after he speaks, he leaves the room and they openly laugh at him. You don't have the locker room. And the biggest faux pas he made when he with the Columbus trip had nothing to do with what happened in the bar. They played a game. They lost a game. All the players had to get on the plane and go home.
Back with his team.
I'm sure that some of those players would have loved to spend time with their friends in some bar that they that they frequent. That they would have spent it with their families. But no, they had to get on the flight and they had to go home. Urban Meyer didn't. He didn't go back with the team. And what was the reason he gave?
Staying with his grandchildren.
Yeah, and he needed some time to clear his head. Well, why did the team not get to do that? Because Urban Meyer has always been and always will be a hypocrite.
I will give you this. You called this.
I didn't call what was going to happen in the
bar. You didn't call what happened in the bar, but you called this exact thing, how short it would be. I'm sure that there's audio of you calling it on the air because we've talked so much on the air about this. Probably when you took the picture with him at the Army-Navy game. Minute and a half left, Jeff. The Philly season is done. I still don't understand. I'm not surprised that they're firing people. I don't get that they fired them before the last game.
Why would you fire two of your coaches right before the last game? Could you not wait?
Give them a day.
What was going to happen that you couldn't wait until after the game?
Wait 3 hours.
It made no sense.
Did it make you happy that Dombrowski said he doesn't know if Didi's going to be back?
Well, no, he didn't say he didn't know if he's going to
be
back.
The starter.
He doesn't know if he's going to be the starter. And that's the thing. Look, if Bryson Stott can carry over what he did in his progression this year, that is the best case scenario for the Phillies.
You saw him play, right? Did you see him?
We interviewed him at the minor league All-Star game a couple years ago too. He's a great kid, and he's got the right mentor. He's very close with Bryce Harper. They're both out in Vegas. They spend time together in the off season. Apparently, they watch football games on Sundays, and he is learning from a guy who busts it all the time. So you're going to have a guy that you know is going to get here and have a right mentality. He's not going to come here and be like Alec Bohm.
Well, that's the fear.
But Alec Bohm, they got to get rid of. Take what you can get. This was another one of their when they overvalued him when they drafted
him. Look, we were doing our minor league show then. Everybody at the time talked about that. Jeff, 5 seconds.
Matt Vierling is better than Alec Bohm.
There you go. We'll leave it at that. Thanks so much for joining us this week. Make sure to join us next Friday night to help you start your weekend in style. Have a great one, and we'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.